If you're like many Americans, you've become increasingly frustrated with a lack of bipartisan cooperation in Congress. How did we get here? And is there a way out? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, columnist and Woodrow Wilson Center scholar Linda Killian will join us. She's author of the new book, The Swing Vote: The Untapped Power of Independence. In it, she chronicles the disappearance of centrist politicians willing to work together to solve the nation's problems. In the first half hour, analysis of the latest politics from Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Bruce Gronbeck of the University of Iowa. It's Politics Day here on River to River, starting right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And later in the hour, we'll be talking with columnist and Woodrow Wilson Center scholar Linda Killian. She'll join us. She's the author of a new book titled The Swing Vote: The Untapped Power of Independence. And she'll chronicle the disappearance of centrist politicians and also talk about so-called independent voters, how they break into different categories and how we might want to think about them. But first of all, in our first half hour, we're joined by two of our regular political analysts. Wayne Moyer is with us, the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Bruce Gronbeck with us, joining us from Colorado, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Hi, Bruce.
Good to be back. Thanks.
And listeners, please feel free to join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, or our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's talk about the political fallout of the Aurora shooting. Little about the nation's gun laws has changed in the wake of this recent high-profile incident of gun violence. All indications are that this movie theater shooting last week in Aurora, Colorado, isn't likely to affect the gun control debate either. Bruce, we're talking to you at your home. You're in Colorado. Of course, Colorado, also the site of the infamous Columbine shooting back in 1999, killed 12 students, one teacher. Colorado, a pro-gun Western state. Give us a sense of the political fallout from this latest shooting.
The political fallout here is pretty much a study of silence and avoidance on the issue of gun control. You do get anecdotal evidence. He just ran a story from a gun dealer that says, boy, I checked these people out and I won't sell them a gun if I don't like the way they look or smell. Alcohol, that is.
Right.
And there's an awful lot of outpouring of support, sympathy, big fundraising for the victims. But again, the first place it looked was to the presidential candidates, both of whom essentially say we've got to enforce the laws we have right now more stringently.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to touch it in either party. The NRA's lock is awful tight, and as tight here as it is anywhere in the country.
Your observations, Wayne Moyer?
Well, I think we still got the underlying problem, and I don't think this affects it. The people who want guns and who think guns are important, for them, that's the single most important issue. And the gun control advocates, it's not usually the single most important issue on which they base their votes. And I don't think the incident in Aurora is going to affect this in any kind of significant way. Although, if we have enough of these instances over time, conceivably public opinion could change.
But don't you see in the trajectory of this? I mentioned Columbine. That's going mm-hmm. back, 13 years. That every one of these, it seems that we become increasingly desensitized or numbed to this sort of violence that Columbine created an uproar for quite a while. It seems like every successive shooting, high-profile shooting, then fades a little quicker.
The slippery slope argument, though, justice has an amazing power to hold, right? Sure, if you take away AK-47s or this case an AK-15, then the rest of our guns are going to go as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that argument has an amazing power to hold on to even the kind of weapons, automatic weapons, were being used in this shooting.
Okay.
One other issue here. There are so many guns out there now that it's not clear that any action that we're likely to take, at least in the short term, would have much overall impact in terms of preventing this kind of thing.
Okay. River to River listeners, what's your opinion? 1-866-780-9100. Are you satisfied with how politicians have reacted to this shooting, other shootings in terms of guns in this country? A challenge, it seems, from a listener on Facebook. Lydia writes, I personally see no reason why an average American needs access to assault weapons. I'm not in favor of banning all firearms, but assault weapons have no place in everyday life in our country. I'd love to hear someone's valid reason for why they should be allowed. A shout-out challenge from Lydia over our Facebook page. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Describe, if you could, Wayne, how do you see the reaction of President Obama and Governor Romney, since they are in the spotlight in this campaign, in the aftermath of this massacre?
Well, I'm honestly quite disappointed with both of them. Obviously, neither of them wants to offend the gun-owning constituency, and so both of them are taking a very cautious, measured position that doesn't really tell us very much. And I really would like to see both of them take stronger stands.
A lot of sympathy, but past that, not much. Outside of a few isolated and expected voices, few political leaders have called for stronger gun laws after this massacre. Here's one of those voices, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg on MSNBC. He's talking about the reaction, as you were, Wayne, of President Obama and presidential hopeful Mitt Romney on this.
They both want a job that during the next presidential term, you will see 48,000 Americans shot with illegal guns.
Mm-hmm.
How can you run for that job without having a plan of what are you going to do? In the United States, we have federal laws that say you can't sell guns to minors, to drug addicts, to people with psychiatric problems, and people with criminal records. And then we deliberately make sure those laws are not enforced. At one point, Congress thought that it was appropriate to pass those laws. But it's a joke to pass a law and then wink, wink, but we're not going to enforce it. The same thing is true with the assault weapon ban.
Mm-hmm.
Governor Romney, when he was the governor of Massachusetts, a state I came from, he signed and talked favorably about a ban on assault weapons. Massachusetts banned assault weapons. The president of the United States, Barack Obama, when he was campaigning, he campaigned in favor of a ban on assault weapons. Where are they?
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Bruce Gronbeck, what section of the United States population do you think he represents in this opinion?
Bloomberg, well, actually a majority of the population, if you count and look at the opinion polls. But you've got to remember that when Obama was campaigning in 2008, you know, and tried to talk about the grip of the right on the country hanging onto their guns, their religion, and their prejudices, he got hit extremely hard. He literally slipped in the opinion polls immediately after that, and that backed him right off that issue. It's a minority, certainly, I think, that wants to hang on to weapons, especially such things as the automatic revolvers and assault weapons, and yet that group is so loud and so firm and seemingly controlling voters, and that's the key, right? Can you mount voters that our elections are so close, generally, that is just a scary button for I think both candidates.
Let's go to our callers. Let's first go to Ames. Michael is with us. Hi, Michael. Not much time, but what's your input here?
Well, I think three
three quick hits here. First of all, this whole discussion is ludicrous. The entire reason why our population is armed with weapons is so that we can defend ourselves against our own government. Anybody who reads about the founders, who reads about the Minutemen going back, whatever, to fifth grade American history knows, we are armed so we can defend ourselves against a tyrannical government. Second point, the 9/11 hijackers caused all that mayhem with $2 box cutters from the hardware store. Timothy McVeigh blew up Oklahoma City with a Ryder rental truck and some corn fertilizer, okay? Bad people can make weapons out of almost anything, so you can't control that. You know, why are we trying to have this conversation focused on just these types of weapons?
Michael, okay. I didn't cut you off, Michael. Somehow you disappeared there on the line. We got two of your 3 points anyway from Michael. Let's go to another caller before we have to end this segment. Scott in West Des Moines. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. What's your input?
My input really is I think the tragedy is whenever these kind of incidents happen, we don't ask the obvious question about mental health, and I think we're really missing the boat. I think we're focusing so much on this hot political debate of gun control that we have completely missed the fact that no sane person walks into a movie theater and opens fire on people. And I think we're avoiding mental health issues in this country. We're avoiding mental health education and awareness in our schools, our places of business. And I think until we address that, I think the whole gun debate is frankly moot.
Okay, Scott, thank you for that from West Des Moines. Wanted to, before we have to switch gears here, switch guests as well, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the rhetoric we've been hearing on the campaign trail, other than the four words that have been coming up. You didn't build that. President Obama has accused Mitt Romney in repeating these words, using these words in the campaign, of misrepresenting the remarks. The presumptive Republican presidential nominee called the comments "you didn't build that," which President Obama did use in a speech, strange and in some respects foreign to the American experience type of philosophy. Now, today, the Romney campaign will host nearly 30 news conferences, including 3 in Iowa, featuring entrepreneurs and small business owners who are deeply offended by the president's comment. I wonder, Bruce, as a person who looks at political rhetoric, you've certainly focused on the "you didn't build that" comment. Can you give us some background?
Background is that he is working very hard to depict Romney as a corporate man, a man who flies so high he doesn't know or touch the workers, the things that are being made and so on, that he lives in the world of corporate finance, not the production of widgets. And that constant refrain, which he really has worked hard on, simply isn't getting him a whole lot of traction, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
Because the countering focus in a lot of Romney stuff and the events you're talking about are a very good example of that, is on the small entrepreneur, the one who builds, the one who hires the people in the local community to make a business work. And that gap between one focusing on, I think, the larger corporate issue, part of the 99%, 1% debate and all those sorts of things, versus the sense of localness. And remember Tip O'Neill, and all politics is local. And if you can hang on to that sense, that vision of the local, I think you get some pretty good political leverage. I think that's the building notion that comes in that camp, mm-hmm. is circulating around that really big gap in those two positions that the candidates are putting out.
Wayne Moyer, you didn't build that. Those four words, of course, both campaigns, in any campaign, try to capitalize on one-liners from the opponent taken out of context. The GOP really digging its teeth into this one line. How effective, how much traction will they be getting out of this going today with 30 news conferences nationwide, 3 in Iowa, to try to really take it to President Obama with this line?
Well, I think what we have going on here is most people have already made up their minds in terms of how they're going to vote in November. there's a very small group that has not made up its mind, and this may relate to the second part of, of your segment today. Most of these people don't follow politics very closely, and both Obama and Romney are trying to appeal to those people to get their attention and activate them enough so they'll actually come out and vote in November. And I think that's what's going on here, and that's what at least partially explains the simplistic remarks on both sides.
Mm-hmm. In fact, closely related to your remark, Wayne, we have a new poll by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press with more than 3 months to go before Election Day. Most voters feel this doesn't indicate that they've already made up their minds. The question in this poll, most voters already feeling that there's little left to learn about the presidential candidates. When it comes to President Obama, 90% say they pretty much know what they need to know about him. A substantial majority, nearly 70%, also say they already know what they need to know about Mitt Romney. Only about a quarter say they need to know more to get a clear impression of Romney. And when Pew combines these two questions, we have fully two-thirds of voters saying they already know as much as they need to know about both presidential candidates. Your view on this, Bruce, about the degree this poll tells us about how much either campaign can influence the electorate with whatever political rhetoric?
Well, you know, in a time when we have, you know, somewhere around 55 elections in the primary and caucus period, and the national news network's picking up many of those, the public has been flooded, as I say, with political information. It's a pity they don't have more political knowledge, but they've been bombarded with bits and pieces of stuff. And the campaign, given the amount of money that both parties and not to mention the super PACs are raising and throwing now into ads. Interestingly, even national ads, which were pretty starting to disappear, but they're back because there's so much money, especially from the super funds that can fund them. The public has been a swarm in this, and of course the broadcast units in public radio has devoted a tremendous amount of time to talking about what the candidates are saying, more than I can remember. So I think the public is feeling saturation of highly repetitious material, and it's getting weary. And of course, the attacks now are getting so personal that I think they are just about at the point where they're going to be driving voters out of the arena. That's a danger point.
Right, and actually, to back up what you were just saying, another poll after these furious attacks on the campaign trail, these ads. Millions of dollars on these hard-hitting ads, the increasingly negative tone of the election. The poll from the latest poll from NBC News and Wall Street Journal says that both presidential candidates have seen their quote very negative ratings increase to an all-time high in the poll. Romney's overall unfavorable score remains a net negative. And incidentally, they mentioned a trait no other modern presumptive GOP presidential nominee has shared, not Bob Dole, not George W. Bush, not John McCain. So what do you make of this, Wayne Moyer? The negatives going up to unprecedented highs for these two candidates as we're 3 months out from the general election.
Well, and this follows from Bruce a little bit. It could mean a low turnout in terms of Election Day. People being turned off. I think in some sense both Obama and Romney are elites, and they are detached from a very good segment of the American community. And I think a lot of these people are, there's a good chance they won't actually turn out to vote as a result of at least the way the campaigning is going. It may contribute to their non-voting.
Mm-hmm. I'll be asking the guest in the second half hour this question, but you're dovetailing nicely into it with this discussion here. So if we have a detached people, perhaps because of the negative campaigning, not motivated to go to the polls, Bruce, can you imagine what message, what tact gets the unmotivated, really disappointed members of our electorate, disappointed in our political system, out to the polls?
It's going to be hard because I think once Once a voter decides that they refuse to vote for the evil of two lessers, they are simply not going to go. It's now, you know, what's changing that a little, of course, is the amount now of early voting and mail voting, which means at least you don't have to go stand in line for 45 minutes. And that may help. But I think the disgust level is rising very strong. We do have, of course, the great high points of the what is usually the positive parts of the campaign, and that is the national conventions, which are large, spectacular celebrations. With certain examples, the negativity of the 92 Republican convention for George Bush certainly wasn't that. But usually they are, and that can pick up the electorate somewhat. And if some of those, and they'll get some positive bounce out of it. But I think, especially with the super funds that are running such strong negative ads, and when we get things on the campaign trail, like a woman asking Romney last week what he's going to do about that monster in the White House, and his only response is, "I wouldn't have used that word." That we have candidates who are reinforcing that negativity themselves on a very personalized level, and that goes both ways in both parties. So I think they are really in trouble, and you can only hope that the conventions will help.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, are you looking forward to anything particular in the conventions as they approach?
Not so much in the conventions. The Democratic convention, I'm not sure I see any. We know who the vice presidential nominee will be. I'm not sure what other kinds of things are likely to develop that will get a lot of attention. The Republicans, of course, still have to name the vice presidential nominee. I'm looking more to the debates afterwards and that they might make some kind of difference and could be uplifting. They may not be, but I'm hoping at least that the level of discussion there will be higher.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, with those debates coming up later in the game, you said most people have decided. What good are the debates?
People have decided, but most polls also are showing just some awfully soft decision that have been made already. Because you really don't expect more than 75-80% to be pretty solid before you even get toward the last week of the campaign. At least that's the way it's been going the last few elections. So that there's still some possibility of movement. Although I agree with Wayne that the debates still can make an awful big difference. That's what finally finished off McCain, for example. He just couldn't hold it in the debates, and it was gone. And George Bush, speaking of him, the Bush 42, couldn't hold it either. So I think that that still is the best event for voters to have in their viewing schedule of the entire campaign.
Bruce Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Thank you for the two of you for joining us this half hour. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, when we come back from a short break, we'll be joined by columnist and Woodrow Wilson Center scholar Linda Killian. She's the author of a new book, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. Are you classifying yourself in this cycle as an independent voter? Tell us why. Why did you become independent? Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this half hour, we want to talk about the independent voter. If you're like many Americans, you've become increasingly frustrated with a lack of bipartisan cooperation in Congress, the disappearance of centrist politicians who are willing to work together to solve our nation's problems. Well, if you feel like this, you share this frustration with my next guest this half hour, Linda Killian, columnist and Woodrow Wilson Center scholar, author of the new book, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. Linda, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me, Ben. I'm also a former editor of All Things Considered, so we can throw that in.
I didn't see that in your bio. Thank you for throwing that in. We want to mention in detail, too, you've been a columnist and writer for The Daily Beast, Newsweek, Politico, U.S. News and World Report, .com, and Politics Daily. Your previous book was called The Freshman, What Happened to the Republican Revolution. Let's talk about this book to start off with, The Swing Vote. You base it on the frustration that many of our listeners feel here, a hyperpartisanship that has been addressed by many analysts, many writers. How did you approach this topic, and what was your goal?
Well, I've been covering politics, as you said, for many years, and I've become increasingly concerned about the hyperpartisanship, about the gridlock, about the inability for Congress and politics to really get things done and address serious problems. And I also was becoming aware that increasingly American registered voters are choosing to disaffiliate from the two major parties. Independent voters now stand at 40% of all registered voters in the country. That's more than either Republicans or Democrats. It's the highest in 75 years since Gallup has been keeping track of it. So I wanted to get at these two conjoining things: why Americans are increasingly disaffected from the two parties, and why things aren't getting done by our politicians.
Okay, perhaps our listeners can help out. To independent voters who are listening, answer the call that Linda Killian just put out there for you. Have you become disaffected from one or the other political party? Tell us why. Tell us your path to becoming an unaffiliated voter this half hour. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, we're also on Facebook, or give us a tweet at IPR Talk. That number again, 1-866-780-9100. Now, Linda, you focused on four key swing states. You talked to many voters in these states: New Hampshire, Colorado, Virginia, and Ohio. Why these four states?
Well, I'm sorry I didn't pick Iowa.
Well, that was my next question, but I thought I'd stay positive for the initial swing there.
Well, I wanted to pick one state in each region of the country and one state that reflected something significant that I saw in the demographic of independent voters. So I sort of came up with four key demographic groups, and I paired one with each state. Although they are all over the country, and I think all four of them are represented in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Go through those four groups, if you could. The subgroups in this demographic of independent voters.
Right. So Colorado is a very represents the Rocky Mountain West and the demographic changes that are happening in the West, both with the increase in Hispanic voters, which has really changed the complexion of the electorate in states like Nevada and New Mexico, but also young voters. Colorado is a very young state, median age under 40. And young voters, who I call the Facebook generation, are registered as independents in a higher percentage than any other age group. They're very disaffected with both parties. The New York Times recently did a piece about this, reflecting exactly what I talk about in the book, that they don't really trust either party, that they want something very different. They'd like more choices. I think we saw this during the primaries in the young voters who voted for Ron Paul in the Republican primary. And they want to see change. They liked what Barack Obama was saying 4 years ago, but they haven't seen the change they want. And, of course, they've been hard hit economically with student loans and looking for jobs. The next group, Ohio, that I talk about, and these voters also very prevalent in Iowa, are Ohio, obviously incredibly key swing state with a lot of electoral votes. No Republican has ever won the presidency without Ohio, and you are going to see Barack Obama and Mitt Romney in Ohio constantly between now and the November election. Group I talk about are what I call the America First Democrats. These are what we have known in the past as Reagan Democrats. These are largely male, socially a bit more conservative, very strong patriotic voters, working class, lower middle class voters. They have been hit very hard by outsourcing. They've seen their jobs go overseas. And I think they are a group, they were not enthusiastic Obama voters 4 years ago. They liked Bill Clinton. They obviously liked Ronald Reagan. They liked Hillary Clinton. They essentially went for John McCain last time around. But I think these voters are up for grabs. And I correspond with a Columbus, Ohio police officer who had been police officers tend to be pretty conservative, had been a traditional Republican voter, but who is working for Barack Obama this time, largely because of the anti-union efforts in Ohio. And so I think this group is up for grabs, and I think this is something the national media may be missing in some of its polling. I really do.
Linda, quickly to the other two groups you mentioned in the book, because we have a loaded phone lines. We want to have some of the independent voters talk to you who are in Iowa.
Okay.
You have New Hampshire and Virginia. Tell us about those groups.
Well, Virginia are a very interesting swing state. Again, very much up for grabs. The group I talk about are the Starbucks moms and dads, suburban, younger voters who swing. They voted for Barack Obama. They swung back to Republicans in 2010. Very much how the suburbs and exurbs go. 50% of the country lives in suburbs and exurbs. This will undoubtedly determine the election. New Hampshire, which is a state with a voting history very similar to Iowa in terms of presidential elections. It has four electoral votes to your six, so slightly smaller, but very similar in that it had been a Republican state up through sort of the late 80s. You had had a Republican voting record until 1988 when you voted Democratic. And then, of course, Iowa in 2004 voted Republican but went for Barack Obama in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So you are a swing state and very similar to New Hampshire in terms of the way your pattern of voting. The group that I identify there are what I call the NPR Republicans.
Why NPR Republicans?
Because they wouldn't be ashamed to admit that they listen to NPR. And they are socially moderate, socially tolerant, fiscally conservative Republicans who did vote for Barack Obama 4 years ago, but who are very much in play this time around.
Linda Killian is with us for this half hour, author of the new book, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. Let's go to our phones to see if we can talk to some independent, unaffiliated voters in Iowa. Scott is in Waterloo. Do you consider yourself unaffiliated this time around, Scott?
I consider myself an independent, and what I consider, I think it should be called the Realist Party, to vote for who you realistically think should be president at that particular time, rather than belong to a certain party. And no matter what your beliefs, if you don't believe in who's running, to vote for them anyway, just because you're Republican or Democrat.
So every election cycle, every 2 years, every 4 years, you hit the reset button and you just include everybody to consider.
Exactly, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you talk to people like that, Linda?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I met, and this is another thing. It's a bit of a myth that some of the reaction to my book, a lot of sort of national political pundits like to say that these independent swing voters don't exist in the numbers that polls show that they do. Even though 40% of all Americans say they're independents, pundits like to say, well, they really lean to one party or another, so it's a much smaller group. Some of that is true, but I think at least a quarter of the electorate, and polls show this, a quarter of the electorate remains undecided this time around, despite all the many millions that have already been spent on campaign advertising. These are the swing voters. If you haven't made up your mind at this point, you're a swing voter. And they do change from election to election, and they do swing, and they do decide on issues.
Okay, let's go to the northwest part of our state. Tom is in Sioux City. Tom in Sioux City, thank you for waiting.
Thank you for taking my call.
What is your path to being described as an independent voter?
Well, mine was a little more personal in that I can't stand Steve King and some of the things that he's done as a Republican congressman, and I dropped out of the Republican Party 18 months ago during one of the first, when he did something that was outrageous regarding the budget. I just couldn't stomach being a member of the same party that he was in. And I'm wondering if there's any of this stuff that's, you know, this disaffiliation is because of, like, personalities or just fed up with some of the Tea Party Republicans that are now in Congress.
Okay, a great question, Tom, especially because Linda looked at the Republican Revolution in an earlier book, too. So what is the motivation you found in talking to independent voters in these four states, Linda, that kicked them out of one of the parties into the center, into the independent column?
Well, extremism in the Republican Party, by Tea Party Republicans, is a factor, and would definitely be a factor with what I call the NPR Republicans. I think the Tea Party represents a piece of the Republican Party, but I by no means think it represents a majority of Republicans. I think a majority of Republicans tend to be more moderate and centrist, or more certainly than Tea Party members, but it's the Tea Partiers who have been making the most noise and showing up and voting in primaries. And if the other Republicans cede the field, then this is what they'll get when it comes to the nominees. And I think, this pressure on Republicans to agree not to compromise, to not to work with Democrats, to hew to this conservative party line, is what has made a number of people independent. Last week, I did Charlotte, North Carolina NPR, and the host was talking about how a Republican that was running for re-election was being attacked as being a moderate, and that this was like calling them a communist or something, you know?
Right.
So I think that's something that, you know, has really affected things. I think also both parties, I think the Republicans have been more regimental about driving out people that don't hew to the conservative line. But I think both parties, when it comes to Congress, when it comes to the way people vote and listening to the party leaders, listening to the base, listening to the fundraisers, are both parties have not been that great at compromising and working together for the good of the nation. And I think that's also a reason why people have become independent.
You write in your book, Linda Killian, about the disappearance of centrist politicians willing to work together to solve our nation's problems. And in your book, you mention a figure in Iowa politics that many of our listeners will recognize. You mentioned former Iowa Republican Congressman Jim Leach, a 15-term member of Congress, defeated in 2006. How does he embody the passionate center that was largely been now is disappearing?
Well, you know, I think Jim Leach was a great member of Congress. I really do. And I think that he is the kind of member of Congress that we need more of, but who has been driven out. And, you know, he is now at the National Endowment for the Humanities here in Washington, and he wears he talks a lot about tolerance and civility. I think he wears a civility lapel pin. He was very much the kind of member of Congress that would work in a bipartisan way and would work on problems and try to address the major issues and challenges this country faces. And I think it has become harder and harder for people like that to get nominated, first of all, within the party structure, and to serve. And I think if he had been running statewide, as opposed to in a district that was sort of gerrymandered to benefit one party or another, I think he probably would have been easier for him to get reelected. And that's one thing I talk about in the book, is that congressional redistricting reform is something we need, as well as open primaries. In half the states in the country, independent voters cannot participate in the primaries, so you're closing out 40% of all voters, and that's also how we get these extreme candidates.
We're running out of time. Other remedies you see here, Linda Killian?
Well, I think I encourage people to get involved. I encourage people, if your state has a ballot initiative process, push for election reform, push for open primaries, push for citizen commissions to do redistricting. give some, get involved, give small campaign contributions. And because small contributions can outweigh some of the influence of big money and PACs and you know, corporate money, I also encourage people to pay attention and to show up and to vote. And I would also encourage people to follow me on Twitter and check out my website. Both are Linda J. Killian, lyndajkillian.com, and that's my Twitter. And you can learn a lot more about this and about other issues and about, you know, read about my book, The Swing Vote.
You mentioned also in your book, we have a couple minutes left, President Obama, looking back on his presidency. Of course, President Obama, as candidate, bursting onto the national political scene back in 2004, his keynote address at the Democratic National Convention, a surprise victory in the Iowa caucuses in 2008, 4 years ago, going on to beat John McCain in the general election, put himself up as a candidate, as a post-partisan candidate. Give us your critique of Barack Obama, his leadership, based on the research you've done, the conversations you've had with independent voters.
Well, I think it, obviously, I think his presidency has been a bit of a disappointment. And I think part of it is the incredibly difficult fiscal situation the country faces. And people are very concerned about jobs and the economy. I also think he had relatively limited experience when he was elected. He was not what you would call a legislator in the Senate. He had barely been there for a couple of years and not done any major legislation. And I think he tends to govern not by, in a sort of Lyndon Johnson way, and I think we saw that with the health care debate. You know, he was, I think, buffeted by party forces and by party leaders, Nancy Pelosi in the House and Reid in the Senate, and Harry Reid in the Senate. And I think they were pretty partisan about the way they handled health care and a number of other issues in the first years of the Obama presidency. And I think that the Republicans have refused to cooperate. And so he's getting it from both sides. Mm-hmm. And I think he's been unwilling to show more leadership. For example, when it comes to his own deficit commission, the Simpson-Bowles Deficit Commission, and now the nation finds itself facing some terrible deadlines that are coming up at the end of this year.
Tea Party Republicans obviously playing a big role in the 2010 election. How do you see their role shaping up as this election comes at us about 3 months away?
I think we're going to see some correction. I think New Hampshire is a state where I think, and we're going to see a number of states where we have some rematches between Democrats that were defeated 2 years ago and the Republican Tea Party people that beat them. And I think we may have some retrenchment and we may have some Tea Party people losing. I don't think the Tea Party is as strong as it was 2 years ago. And I don't think it's going to be a factor in the presidential race. I really don't. I think what the question will be is, will these independent swing voters turn out in the presidential election, and how will they vote? Mm-hmm. And I think that is definitely an open question at the moment.
And quickly, in the minute or so we have left, the keys to getting those independents to come out and to convince them that you're the candidate?
Talk about substance. Talk. Don't just run negative campaign ads. Talk about substance. Talk about issues and policies and what you would do to move the country forward.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen, in observing the campaigns, the Romney and Obama campaigns thus far, have you seen any sort of unforced errors?
Nothing super major. I think Romney's taxes are going to be an issue if he doesn't release them. And I think people will think there's a big reason he's not releasing them. Like, maybe he didn't pay taxes in one of those years. Maybe he had so many tax shelters that he, you know, he didn't pay taxes. As we know already, he paid, you know, the vast majority of his income is from investments, and so he pays the investment rate of currently about 14%, which is way below what you pay on earned income. So I think that's an issue. I think the American people don't, you know, they celebrate achievement and wealth that people earn, and they don't resent that. But I think there is a question about fairness in terms of the tax rate over the past decade for the wealthy.
Will that matter if the economy continues to, well, not recover and even tank a little bit?
Well, that's the big question. And I actually saw a great Republican ad this morning because I see Virginia television. Virginia, I'm sure you're seeing in Iowa. And it was not negative. It was just factual about what has happened in the past 4 years with the economy.
Okay.
And it said, Obama tried, we tried, is it time for a change? And that's going to be the question, I think, for Americans.
Linda Killian, we'll leave it there, columnist and Woodrow Wilson Center scholar. Her new book, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of Independence. Linda, thank you for taking the time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ben.
River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Talk to you again tomorrow. Thank you.